Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
We've got a Keto Masterclass testimonial from Allison. Allison says, Rob Wolf, I am so glad I spent the $49 and finally learned to do keto correctly. I'm trying not to geek out on numbers, but I've lost 5.5 inches on my waist, 18 pounds, and it's day 35. I'm telling everyone I know, Keto Masterclass. So if you want to go keto, but you're not quite sure where to start, or maybe you're eating keto already, but not sure you're doing it right, go to ketomasterclass.com/go.
Hey folks, welcome back to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I'm sitting here with my incredible wife, Nikki Violetti. Wife, what's going on?
I'm good, honey. Just laughing at your...
So it's a little warm in my office. The air conditioning is not working that well, so I pulled my shirt off, and then I looked at her and said, hey, I encourage you to pull your shirt off, too.
And I'm just chuckling.
That would make me want to do a podcast every single day. Not that I don't want to do them anyway, but that would definitely align incentives properly for getting work done.
There we go. And good things, these aren't video podcasts, so...
No. Nobody wants to see us naked. But, So what's new? How you doing? You had a little bit of a back dinger recently?
Yeah, I was pulling some weeds and after 3 hard days of rolling, which puts you in a pretty kind of hip flexor dominant position, I guess, for those 3 days.
And yeah, then and then Nikki.
I didn't do adequate back extension work and then went out and did a serious weed session and...
Pulling weeds, not
smoking weed. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, I think I'm like 95%. I'm doing good. Yeah.
Cool. Well, should we jump into this?
Let's
We've got a whole bunch of a lot here today. So.
Yep. Okay. Let's see. Our first question has to do with kidney stones. Christian says, I've been mostly paleo for about 5 years now based on one of your prior books. Overall, it has worked well for me with one exception. I started to develop kidney stones on a regular basis. I finally had them analyzed and they turned out to be calcium oxalate stones. Upon reading up on this condition, it stems from a high amount of oxalate in the diet. Unfortunately, most of the foods I like on paleo happen to be super high in oxalate. Spinach, nuts, seeds, dark chocolate, and sweet potatoes. The other whammy here is that I was initially avoiding dairy on paleo, which turns out to be worse for stones because one way to counteract high oxalate intake is to match it with high calcium to avoid stone formation. I've since gone back to eating plenty of cheese and high-fat dairy in my diet. I'm curious if this is a common issue that you've seen, and I'm wondering if this is something that might be helped by going to a keto diet.
Oh, man, it's a really good question. And, you know, I guess that main piece, I guess 2 questions here. Like, is this common and would a keto diet fix this? One, it is a bit common. One of the unfortunate things that has happened with our change in our gut microbiome is that a lot of the bacteria that degrade oxalates are absent in kind of the modern Western gut. When some research has been done on the Hadza, it's interesting. They eat a remarkably high oxalate diet, but the oxalate tends to get processed in the gut by bacteria. And so it doesn't really have a metabolic, you know, effect for people. So, what do you do with that? Some strains of probiotics may help with that. I'm off the top of my head, I have no idea what the specific strains are that you would want to approach from, trying to improve your oxalate clearance capacity. Some people have reported improvements with a fecal transplant, but that's kind of a last resort deal.
Yeah.
The turkey baster of doom is kind of
might not be a popular option.
Right. So, you know, I think that what you've done here is a really slick, you know, way to navigate this. If you don't have problems with dairy, like a pro-inflammatory response or what have you, then I really, you know, it's one of those things. Have as much variety in the diet as you can so that we, up to the point that we start seeing some deleterious effects. And so I think that that's a great way to handle it. The shifting to a keto diet, I wouldn't really see being much of a viable option because it's still a lot of the same stuff. You know, dark chocolate can still be in there. You're not doing sweet potatoes, but you're doing some nuts. You're doing some seeds. You're doing some greens potentially. So, I mean, you could shift things around and find like some low oxalate options. Like I'm pretty sure jicama is a low oxalate option. Varieties of squash are low oxalates, and then others are higher oxalate. So you could just kind of go and create yourself kind of a general food list and pull that down. But just simply shifting to a ketogenic diet is not really going to be the solution there.
Sorry.
Nikki's wanting to take some notes.
Okay.
On to sugar addiction.
Is that all you have to say?
That's all I have to say on that.
Yeah. Okay. Question number two is from Catherine. Hey, Rob, I'm really hoping you can give me some insight into why I can't seem to fully recover from sugar addiction. I've had a sweet tooth my whole life, but in recent years I've learned that I have a true addiction to sugar. In the last 4 years or so, I have studied a lot of nutrition, functional medicine, and ancestral health perspectives, and gone on a strict paleo diet for months at a time. In almost every way, a clean diet of whole foods makes me feel amazing. Better sleep, clearer skin, joints and movement feels better, etc. Except I become very depressed. It's not a mopey, weepy kind of depressed. It's literally a depression of all feeling, like I feel very little at all. But I do sometimes feel really, really, really irritable, or sometimes bouts of rage that don't match the situations they arise in. But most of the time, I just feel blah. I thought this would go away after a couple of weeks or even a month or two of eating clean, but it didn't. In happy or exciting moments, it was like I just couldn't feel those emotions fully. I also noticed that I didn't crack jokes like I usually do or feel like being social. All my feelings were dulled, even sad ones. And when I did fall off the diet and eat sugar, I immediately felt cheerful again. To me, it seems that the years of sugar abuse have altered my brain enough that without sugar, I can't feel normal emotions anymore. So my question is concerning healing my brain. Is it possible to reverse these effects? The longest I've gone on a strict paleo diet is 3 months, and I admit it was hard to keep going when I just didn't see myself ever feeling happy again. If it is possible to heal my brain and increase its capacity for proper dopamine signaling again, are there certain types of therapies or supplements that can precipitate and accelerate that healing? Perhaps I'm ignorant of some other factor or mechanism at work. I would be grateful for any insight you can help or give. Thanks for the incredible work you do to bring light to the truth about human health and nutrition.
Man, so that's a lot to unpack, but this is one of the interesting things that we've seen with a ketogenic diet is that some people do seem to have suffered what would effectively be like some sort of like brain damage, brain alteration, specifically in the hippocampus. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, people that have struggled and failed with every other approach, they end up succeeding on a ketogenic diet, because if we know that there's one area of efficacy for ketones and a ketogenic diet, it's generally with neurological issues. This gets stronger and stronger every day, and this runs from epilepsy to Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, and even kind of extends into traumatic brain injury. So, you know, it's tough because on the one hand, clearly you seem to feel better in some ways eating some sugar, but I'm guessing what's not stated here, but what I'm guessing is that the sugar maybe turns into a feed forward mechanism and there might be some weight problems and some other health problems. If there's not, then maybe we just try to find some sort of a middle ground there where,
like, you know, if you feel healthy and you're happy with your body composition, then
we don't really need to mess with this. But if that's not the case, which I'm assuming that's kind of what we're talking about here, then I would recommend, you know, exploring something that looks like a ketogenic diet. It could even be a low glycemic load diet that is supplemented with MCT oil, which would be called an MCT ketogenic diet. Like, there's a lot of different things that you could do there. A good friend of mine, Dr. William Wilson, he developed a product. I have no financial ties to this thing whatsoever, but it's called Carb 22. I will put a link to that in the show notes. And that thing is interesting in that it provides a bunch of cofactors to help with sugar metabolism, but on this kind of dopamine and neurotransmitter side, it provides all of the substrates that lead into the primary neurotransmitters. So it helps to support normal neurotransmitter function. So it's a pretty slick product. And then finally, there's a recent podcast, episode 69 of STEM Talk. My good friends Don Kernagis and Ken Ford, they interviewed Dr. David LeMay, and he's talking about inflammation and SPMs, which are, I'm blanking on, pro-resolving mediators called SPMs. But this is really interesting stuff. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But they are using these products to help with traumatic brain injury and a host of other issues. And so that might be a direction that you could go. And in that podcast, Dr. LeMay talks about using fish oil and even like a very low dose aspirin, like taking a baby aspirin and cutting it in half, doing it a couple of times a week. But what that does is in the inflammatory response, and this is part of the reason why NSAIDs or anti-inflammatories are problematic for injuries and they end up being problematic for cardiovascular disease. We have a front end of the inflammatory response and then kind of a back end. And the back end is the resolution phase. And you need that resolution phase. But some of the things that we use generally, like NSAIDs, it blocks both the front and the back end. And so we don't really get the total improvements that we would like to see. And you have to have that resolving phase to deal with brain inflammation and normal neurotransmitter function. It's a really interesting episode, but that might also be some areas to poke around. So think about a ketogenic diet. Perhaps check out this supplement called Carb 22, which we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And then check out that STEM Talk episode 69 to learn about inflammation and SPMs.
Okay. All right. So our next question is from Julia and has to do with metabolic flexibility and weight loss and maintenance. Rob and Nikki, I'm very interested in the concept of metabolic flexibility and eagerly awaiting to hear your upcoming lecture on this topic. Intuitively, it makes sense that given variation in season and climate, that humans would have relied on a menu of macronutrient combinations. My question is, how can developing metabolic flexibility be used as a tool for weight loss or maintenance? I have been about 90% ketogenic for the past 28 months. The other 10% would be high-carb meals, which I have allowed as a metabolically flexible person. I can swing in and out of ketosis with ease. However, I have noticed that if I go through periods of higher carb, it does result in weight gain, which is tough to lose even when re-entering ketosis. I do CrossFit almost daily and practice the 18-6 intermittent fasting schedule. And I don't notice either of those things affecting my performance. Thanks.
Man, it's interesting. The main argument that I would have with pursuing some of these metabolic flexibility pieces, like in a very simple illustration of this, would be, say, during the spring and summer, maybe like May through August or something like that, you're a lot more flexible with the carb intake, although I would still generally steer people towards largely whole unprocessed foods. You know, we're talking maybe a shift between paleo, in quotations, during the spring, summer, beginning of the fall, and then maybe the depths of winter, we go with more of a ketogenic state. Like, there's some arguments for shifting back and forth around that. The concerning feature here is that you're gaining, Julia's gaining body fat when she kind of does these swings. So I don't know if we just have some really highly processed foods and we're getting
How high is high?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Are we going from you know, keto levels, 25 grams a day to 100, or are we going to 400? What does that look like?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned from Tyler and Luis over at Keto Gains is although they have variation within what they're doing, if somebody reaches a level of leanness and athletic performance where they feel like they just need some more carbs, then they just kind of titrate the carbs up. And they have a lot of small females over there. And it's kind of funny because the name is Keto Gains. So they, you know, people assume that every single thing that they do is all ketogenic diet related, but they have a number of small females that are really active and they just seem to do better 100, 120 grams of carbohydrate a day. And they kind of recommend, you know, a largely whole unprocessed paleo type diet to fit that bill. So although, you know, this metabolic flexibility idea, I think is really powerful and it's something that we should keep an eye on, I think that the really dramatic changes like day to day could be problematic. And if you look at, say, like the approaches of doing a cyclic ketogenic diet, That seems to be really problematic for people. And this is where, like, you usually have, like, a meal a week or 2 days out of the week that you do a carb-free feed and then you're low-carb the rest of the time. That approach really doesn't seem to work that well. What seems to work better is either generally staying in ketosis or generally having something that is in that moderate carb intake. And that really big punctuated change doesn't seem to work that well for folks, other than certain situations where, like, they're doing a marathon or an adventure race or something like that, and they really need to fuel appropriately. So I would think about just generally kind of rounding those edges a little bit. Like, if you're going to do a ketogenic block, do a ketogenic block. And then if you want to do some more carbs, slowly titrate those carbs up and you know, find a maintenance level. And clearly when you titrate those carbs up, you got to titrate the fat down, you know, commensurately. And a just kind of rule of thumb is every 2 grams of carbs that you add, you delete 1 gram of fat. It's not perfect, but it's pretty damn close. We're talking 8 calories versus 9 calories, but that's a way to tackle this.
That could be what's going on too. The calorie, yeah. The calories are shifting up. If she's not deleting the fat, then the calorie content
could be. It's really easy to do because you get comfortable eating these higher fat meals, which are, it's generally okay. But if you throw high fat plus carbs, appetite increases, the total caloric load increases, mm-hmm. This is, whether it's paleo or vegan or what have you, it's that middle ground of fat-carb combos that are the killer, and it's going to those edges where most people find that they can actually make some headway.
Okay. Our next question is on low afternoon energy, and it's from Laura. She says, "Hi, Rob and Nikki. Thank you both for all you do. I've been a huge fan since 2010 and admire your relentless pursuit of the truth when it comes to health and nutrition."
Got her fooled.
"My question is about my extremely low energy in the early afternoons. I know it is a common complaint, but I feel like I've done everything I can to fix the common mistakes that lead to the afternoon slump. And I also feel like my exhaustion is too extreme to be normal for my age and health status. I'm 32 years old. I eat low carbish, 75 to 100 grams most days. I've toyed with keto, eat mostly paleo with the addition of some dairy and occasional non-gluten grains. I do CrossFit 3 times a week and spend most of my time chasing my 2-year-old around. My sleep is good most of the time, and I do not have any major life stressors that affect me currently. No diagnosed health conditions and no prescription meds. I had blood work done recently, and my doctor was very impressed with the results, especially my blood lipids. A1C was 4.8, C-reactive protein was 0.8, no thyroid antibodies present, fasting blood sugar 78. The only things that were slightly out of range were homocysteine, slightly low at 4.6, uric acid was low at 2.4, serum iron slightly high at 148, and my free T3 was a little low at 2.5. Another doctor years ago prescribed me Natrathroid, but I never took it. I've tried changing my diet in every way imaginable to try to combat a possible hypoglycemic or food sensitivity-related slump after lunch. I've eliminated various foods that people can be sensitive to, and I've even tried more carbs in the morning, but that leads to blood sugar imbalance and cravings all day. As a result, my breakfasts and lunches would fall under the keto umbrella, as I feel better when I eat carbs later in the day. The only thing that seems to slightly help is not eating at all, but I just get so hungry. My activity level is fairly high, and I don't feel like I'm a great candidate for intermittent fasting at this point. My mom, who has had MS for about 30 years, does not eat all day and only eats dinner because she says eating makes her tired. I just can't handle not eating at all, and I do feel fatigued and hypoglycemic if I try to skip meals. Thanks for reading and for all you do."
Man, when I first read through this, I was thinking thyroid, and then the fact that one healthcare provider has recommended some thyroid, the Natrathroid specifically, that's kind of the direction that I would nose around this. And maybe this is something that we need to do a little tear sheet on, like similar to the blood lipid testing. Like, people go and get a standard lipid panel, and it just doesn't tell us a damn thing. Like, it's more confusing than not 90% of the time. They really need to get, like, an LPIR score that includes an LDLP. We want to check LP little a at least once. And then similarly with thyroid testing, just looking at T3, just looking at TSH doesn't tell us the whole story. Like, it would be really good to see reverse T3. It would be really good to see a total thyroid uptake, to see the iodine status. Like, when you're there's this process of triangulation when you're trying to find where you are on a map or something like that. And you need three vectors going in. And I find that, you know, when we're dealing with blood sugar issues, like if somebody is eating low carb and they have an elevated morning fasting blood glucose, that might be concerning or it might not matter. And what we need to do to figure that out is we need to look at A1C also. And if A1C is normal, then we're not super concerned, but we'll maybe do some additional follow-up with a fructosamine. And if both A1C and fructosamine are low, then we know that elevated morning blood glucose is some dawn phenomenon. We don't need to freak out about it. But if A1C is high, then we need to make sure that we have the fructosamine to validate whether or not the A1C is elevated due to red blood cells living longer or elevated blood glucose levels. So, you know, and this is similar with regards to the thyroid again. And so, you know, I would circle back around and try to get a more comprehensive thyroid panel done. And we will, Nikki took a note and we're going to do a little tear sheet on this and, help people get the better recommended thyroid testing, and then you will be able to triangulate in on that. The only other thought here is that there might be something gut-related where we're getting kind of a pro-inflammatory response, but it may be both of these. This is one of the challenges of tracking this stuff down. If we have an elevation in inflammation, then we oftentimes get a suppression in the conversion of T4 to T3 and an elevation in reverse T3. I had Dr. Brian Walsh on a podcast, 2 years ago, and I thought I knew this stuff reasonably well, and he absolutely blew me out of the water. And he talked about the fact that there are some both benefits and challenges to that immune suppression that comes about via elevated cortisol and how the body is trying to manage all of this by suppressing some thyroid function. But it's good on the one hand, but ends up being bad on the other, and it still ultimately is not addressing the fundamental issue. So we'll put a link to the Brian Walsh podcast, and then I would do some nosing around on the thyroid, and we will also put out a thyroid testing cheat sheet so that people go get the complete package. And sometimes it's a bugger. Like even in our clinic at Specialty Health, I've had to kind of bludgeon the doctors and the nurses a time or two because it is very non-standard of care. It's quite comprehensive. It can be a little bit more expensive, but you really just don't know what's going on. You're just kind of operating in the dark. And if there is a thyroid issue, then using something like the Nature Thyroid would make a lot of sense. And oftentimes people go on like a half a grain, a quarter grain. They do that for 6 months, then they titrate off, and then everything's fine. Like the body is able to normalize and get ahead of that inflammatory cycle.
So it's not
cycle.
Like she would have to take it forever.
She might. Some people do, but I would say maybe 50% of folks, they just kind of need an intervention to get them over the hump, and then the body recovers.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's see. Our next question is from Carl on carb test and ketosis. Hey, Rob, I read Wired to Eat while I was pretty deep into a ketotic cycle, so I didn't immediately get to the 7-day carb test. Years of self-experimentation have led me to a relatively low carb, less than 50 grams a day, paleo diet with an occasional 48-hour fast, an occasional ketotic cycle, and a very occasional carb refeed. Genetic testing revealed some SNPs that predispose me to insulin resistance and others that positively affect my fat metabolism, reinforcing the fact that I look, feel, and perform better eating in this fashion. I do enjoy my occasional carb binges, so I'd like to perform the carb test in order to whittle away my foods to whittle my food selections down to those least damaging to my metabolism. But I'm concerned that my postprandial blood glucose readings will be skewed upward because I don't regularly eat more than 10 or 15 grams of effective carbs at a time. Should I bring my daily and per meal carb intake up for a certain period of time before starting the carb test, or is a 50-gram bolus of carbs small enough to give me a true measure of glucose tolerance for the purpose of food selection? Thanks in advance.
Ah, man, you know, Carl, given that this appears to be just kind of like, what I'm taking from this is Carl's asking, hey, man, how do I figure out which variety of cookie I can eat and have it be the least impactful? So in that case, I really don't see the benefit of doing the carb test. Like what you're recommending, if you wanted to kick the tires on this and really vet it out, then yeah, you would probably want to to increase your daily carbohydrate intake to 75, 100 grams a day, reestablish kind of a baseline of more normalized carb tolerance. We would likely reverse any type of physiological insulin resistance that's sparing glucose for the brain. But at the end of the day, like what you're describing is a lot like the way that I look. Like my genetics suggest that I'm not well primed to handle carbs. I'm a little bit unique, or there are people out here that I should probably do more monounsaturated fats than tons of saturated fat. So like bulletproof coffee with butter is not really a great idea for me. But otherwise, I'm really well set up for low carb and a ketogenic diet. And at a minimum, just kind of be more fat, you know, fueled than carb fueled. But I too will occasionally, you know, we'll go out and we'll have some Vietnamese food, and I'll get if I've done a really hard jujitsu day, I'll do a bowl of pho. I'll do double meat, like one quarter the noodles, and then I may not even eat all those noodles. And so I just kind of let that stuff pop up as it happens. I don't make it a super regular thing, because if I do, I start feeling really bad. And so I would kind of lean towards just let this stuff pop up when it does. Try to do it after a workout. Try to take a walk after having the meal. All of those things will help you to mitigate the blood glucose response, and then I wouldn't really worry about it that much.
But if he wants to test it and, like, see if, like, he tolerates rice, I mean, I don't know what he does when he does his carb binges, but, like, you know, maybe he wants to see if rice is a better fit for him than, you know, sweet potatoes or you know, beans. You
could certainly do that. In that case, I would give yourself maybe a 2-week period of just kind of eating at that baseline of 75 to 100, 120 grams of carbs, dial the fat down appropriately, and then test with that. Right. Yeah.
Unless, you know, once you start dialing it up and you start feeling like crap, like, then it's maybe not worth the test.
and that's what my experience always was, you know, like, love Paul Jaminet, brilliant guy, but when the safe starches were all the rage, like, God, man, I tried and tried and wanted to believe, but I felt like shit on that. Like, it just didn't work for me. And even though all the boogeyman of, you know, my penis falling off and my gut lining degrading if I was in ketosis long term, like, it was kind of like, okay, so I feel like shit so that I avoid these problems. Like, that just didn't make sense. So, yeah.
Okay. Next question is from Peter. I think it's a 2-part question.
Yes. And a long one.
A long one on creativity and the writing process. Okay, he says, firstly, I'm a writer and I'm always curious about how others approach the creative process. Could you elaborate on how you approach writing and creativity in regards to balancing an active lifestyle and how a typical day when writing might look? For example, do you do things like meditate? What time of the day do you write? Where do you write? If you write in the morning, how do you reconcile with hanging outside first thing in the morning to get some sun? If you do jiu-jitsu around noon and roll for 2 hours, how do you write around it? You've mentioned eating big meals in the morning. If you're in a heavy writing period, is this a habit you stick with? Oh, by the way, you have wife and kids. How do you balance it all? do you still do caffeine? Do you force yourself to take breaks during writing? How do you avoid sitting for 5 to 6 hours straight? Sorry for all the questions. I've just been thinking about this a lot lately as I enter into a career pursuing my passion as a writer while trying to balance and prioritize my health. As I'm sure you can attest, writing can be all-consuming if you let it, and setting boundaries is vital, though difficult, especially if you're in the zone. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
So that's kind of the first chunk, which has like 50 sub questions in here. So like when I've been writing a book, or when we put together the Keto Masterclass and I'm really in a focus chunk, like, I generally prep my food the night before. I grab my coffee, although I'm in a tea mode right now.
You're a tea in the summer guy.
Yeah, it's funny, man. In the summer, coffee just doesn't work for me. It's really funny. But you know, generally I will get all my stuff squared away. I'll get up, shower, grab my caffeinated beverage of choice, have my food ready. And then I get out of the house, and we tend to go to bed pretty early, and I get up pretty early.
You wake up pretty early.
I wake up pretty early. And man, that if I can get to the office by like 5:30 or 6 a.m. and write for 3 hours, like, I can smash it. Like, mm-hmm. I am just on point. That is definitely when my best writing occurs. And then doing physical activity a little bit later in the day, doing a bit more mundane, low CPU, you know, necessitating stuff, email, all that stuff. That's when I would prefer doing that. I have a little bit been getting outside and doing my morning writing outside, and that's actually been really legit. It's a little challenging because we have two kids out of school right now, and man, once they get underfoot, then the, you know, the ability to focus kind of goes out the window. But I do that. So I am doing and you know, just on a general, like, kind of creativity side, I don't do anything like meditation. I will use occasionally a app called Brainwave where I'll plug that in. I'll do a little caffeine. I'll do a little nicotine gum. I will maybe do some of the racetams, some of these things that are kind of nootropics. And but on the really the what I would consider creative side, I try to read a really broad cross-section of material. I read science fiction. I read history. I try to check out different blogs and podcasts. Like, I listen to History on Fire. I listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Like, I find listening to and consuming things from economics, physics, thermodynamics, you know, like just kind of getting out and listening to other things. I try to take in some stuff around game theory. I try to consume material that is focused on like these really big picture topics that govern the world. And I find that I get some really big inspiration from that. And I would say that if I'm uniquely gifted in this area at all, it's in the synthesis. Like, I'm able to take some stuff from economics and evolutionary biology and thermodynamics and kind of plug it in and make it germane to like a ketogenic diet, you know? So that's a critical piece for me. Like, if I get bogged down in just reading papers on metabolic pathways and stuff like that, like I really don't have much of a creative process going. So consuming a wide variety of material not directly in my domain is really helpful, but I always need to be peppering in the latest updates in you know, what's hot and happening. Like, I just referenced that podcast on SPMs from STEM Talk, and that thing's just mind blowing. Like, it connected a ton of dots for me.
And then one of the questions is, how do you avoid sitting for 5 to 6 hours straight?
So I do tend to do Pomodoros from Barbara Oakley. Was she the one that recommended that?
I think she did. She made it kind of more popular, but it's a pretty popular technique.
Yeah. So I set a timer at about 25 minutes. 25 minutes happens. I get up, do some active mobility work, stretch my hip flexors. Maybe I'll even do like some squats, hip bridges, push-ups, handstand push-ups, something like that. But I'll do like a 5-minute mobility break. Occasionally, if I'm really on a tear and I'm really focused, I will skip it and then I'll program the thing in and go again. And occasionally I will delete them. And occasionally I will end up sitting on my ass, you know, for 2 hours straight, 3 hours straight. But it on those days, like, I'm just so focused and the writing is going so well, I'll get 3,000, 3,500 words of writing done, which it ends up being really good writing. If the process is a little more fragmented, then I'll get up and wiggle around and move and do all that type of stuff.
Okay. So the second part of the question is, I'd love to get your thoughts on the mechanisms at play when writing or doing anything else that requires intense mental focus in regards to willpower. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like for me, many aspects of writing and maintaining a healthy lifestyle, choosing healthy food over shitty stuff, hitting the gym, walking, etc., can drain from the same willpower tank, if not just psychologically and physically, physiologically as well. This isn't to say that both can't exist. Rather, does one need to be given priority based on ordering of events throughout the day? For example, I feel my creativity comes to me first thing in the morning. If I were to wake up and hit a Metcon first thing, I feel my creativity gets depleted from the shared willpower tank. I feel this to be true with little things that can chip away at my early morning start time as well. For example, taking the time to make a big healthy breakfast, sitting in the sun, even a short walk, all delay me tapping into when I feel I am creatively primed. But is it worth the sacrifice of my health? I was curious if you have any thoughts on when or how you prioritize creativity, or maybe this is all just a bunch of bullshit like Robert Rodriguez says, and our creativity is totally out of our control. Anyways, love the show and everything you do. If I had more time, I would have written you a shorter letter.
It's funny how more time creates more concisity in some ways. You know, so this is Peter. You know, I'm pretty similar, and that's why I do pack the food ahead of time when I'm really in a writing mode.
On days where Rob stays and helps, you know, with the kids in the morning, helps get them ready for school, you know, breakfast, all of that, like, he definitely is not as productive, doesn't get
a fraction of the work done.
And so if you're working on a book or you're working on some kind of big project with a deadline, you're always out early.
Right.
And that's just kind of the balance that we do, you know? And you help a ton in the house anyway. But you're so focused, you do your best work in the morning. And so then after you do your work, do your jiu-jitsu, get some exercise in, and then you're free to play and, you know, be with the family in the evening.
Yeah. Yeah. So whether it's putting together a slide deck for like my metabolic flexibility talk or doing some writing, we're doing a bunch of work with the Chickasaw Nation right now, and there's some really interesting stuff going with that I needed to generate material and be on point with. I just have to prep my food ahead of time, get out the door, and like literally every, like, I wish that I had kind of like the firefighter like pole to slide down, and on the way down my clothes just like whoosh, onto my body and I could just zip out the door, because that you know, like 5:30 to 9 a.m., 5:30 to 10 a.m. period, I'm five times more productive in that window of time. And so I don't during those blocks of time, I don't work out first thing in the morning. I don't do other things first thing in the morning. Like, that creativity piece is huge. And to the motivation part, I would say that, when I've got a project that I'm very fortunate in, that I get to work on projects mainly that I'm excited about, and that's mainly what drives all this stuff. And so it's pretty easy. Like, that is the one thing I want to do, you know, so it's kind of cool. So it's not like, oh man, I have to go sit down and write. And, you know, it's actually something that I really want to do. When I had an idea around the metabolic flexibility talk, like, I was, you know, hair on fire for that, because it was really fun and I was learning a ton of stuff in the process of doing it. And just as an aside, this is what's always totally fucking hilarious to me when people write book reviews. They're like, there was nothing new in here, I already knew all this shit. And it's like, I learn a ton of stuff writing the book, and then why didn't that asshole write the book then? That's total aside. Like, most of the projects I do, I'm excited to do them. And I'm very fortunate to be able to have that be, you know, my current reality. But this is 20 years of working in this area, so I guess you finally built a little bit of momentum that way. But anything else you could think of that touch on? It's a great topic, and it, you know, just throwing this out there, related to writing, I get tons of questions about, should I write a book? How should I write a book? What are the ins and outs of that? And I've stopped and started on podcasts multiple times. And what I'm going to do is have three different people that are in my world and very tied into the book publishing industry. And I'm going to bring them on, and we're going to ask a bunch of these questions. So it's either going to be like one mega podcast, or it's going to be like a three podcast series about, should you write a book or not? What are the pluses and minuses? What should you think about that? What's the publishing process like, when do you get an agent? When do you go it alone? When do you do, you know, self-publishing and all that type of jive? So just related to that, we will have that popping up here at some point in the next like three to six months. Was that it?
I think that was our final question. Awesome. For today.
Okay, wife, anything else you want to wrap up with?
No, I think we're good.
Cool. All right, guys. Thanks, guys, for the best questions ever. The questions are better than the answers, but I guess that's the way life is. So thank you, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the Paleo Solution Podcast. Here's a quick message from one of our sponsors.
I fly, it's a little biplane, single seater, very basic. And I do aerobatic competitions, which the way I describe it to people is figure skating in the sky.
That's Mitch, a Sleep Cocktail customer in Santa Cruz, California. Mitch had a nagging shoulder injury that just would not heal.
The injury happened, I was at an aerobatic contest, and I would, you know, get up there yanking the stick around, and I get back on the ground and I'm going, holy cow, like, I almost threw up. It hurt that bad. Some wise guy over there at your house said sleeping is healing. So.
Is lack of sleep affecting your body's ability to recover? Try Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.
I hope this helps. Boy, those are making such a big difference. And I'm going to share some with another friend of mine that has sleep issues. So I'm trying to put the word out on this.